This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Good morning. My name is Jerry, and I'm an intelligence analyst with the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And I am joined this morning with Steve Cremondo, who is the Director of Training at the New Jersey's Division of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Jerry. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
All good.
Steve, could you provide us a bit more insight into what your role is?
Well, the Disaster and Terrorism Branch is part of the Division of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and our role is twofold. One is to oversee kind of New Jersey's disaster mental health programs. New Jersey was actually one of the first states to develop credentialed disaster mental health responders. So these are the folks you see working, providing emotional support in places like shelters after storms, but go way back to, you know, working with New Jersey families at the Ground Zero attack or providing support at the anthrax screening centers back in the fall of 2001. So we're all about kind of understanding the psychological and the behavioral aspects of disasters and terrorism.
Great. So I know you recently published an article on surviving vehicular attacks, such as the attack seen in London last week, as well as in Nice, Berlin, and at Ohio State University. Can you give me some more information based on this article?
Well, yeah, there's kind of a lot to think about from a behavioral standpoint, as well as a physical security standpoint. I mean, one at a strategic level, when you think about these vehicle attacks, they're just kind of another form of mass violence. There's actually a lot of similarities between an active shooter or a mass shooting event and a vehicle attack. The attacker tends to pick a soft target, tends to pick a target-rich environment, such as a parade or some large public gathering, probably has no relationship with the victims. And you see a lot of similarities, as I said, to what we have seen in sort of mass shooting events. The interesting thing about it is, I think from the strategic standpoint of the terrorist, using this kind of concept of diversity of tactics, it seems like just another thing. And it's very frightening, I believe, to the public, who feels like, wow, we just learned about mass shooting events. We just learned about run, hide, fight, and how to protect ourselves and our schools from a shooting event. And here's something new and different. And that by design, as I said, at a strategic level, kind of creates the sense of vulnerability that this, you know, terrorist is always one step ahead of us. So that works for a degree to the hand of the terrorist. But as I said, when you think about it from a defensive standpoint, it's another form of mass violence. And what we've shared with the public about things like run, hide, fight strategies in an active shooter event, a lot of the mindset still applies to even something that seems so exotic like a vehicle attack.
Right. So you brought up a couple good points there. The first thing I want to talk on is, how can we leverage current training programs to prepare people for terrorist attacks like these that we've seen over the past couple of weeks?
Well, I think there's two important things when we think about training, and not just necessarily training in the mental health or psychological aspects, but training that we do all around the state about preparing for and responding to violence. And there's two things I think that are really important. And one is sharing with people an understanding of the risk, but also an understanding about the defense. And just to speak about that one section, we're all keenly aware, and very often in our circles we talk about situational awareness. And when we speak to anyone about situational awareness, we have this tendency to focus on the risks. You know, look out for a person on a warm day who's wearing a heavy coat, look for that unattended package or backpack, something that stands out as an anomaly. When we think about mass violence, I believe in training, it's equally important, regardless of who's doing the training and the context of the training, to teach people that good situational awareness involves being aware and vigilant of both risks and resources. And what I mean by resources, of course, are not what would hurt me. That's the risk side of the equation. What would help me if I were in a different sort of risk situation? If I'm standing on the street during a parade and out of the blue I see this vehicle coming quickly down the street, driving erratically, what have I kind of observed going into the parade route or into the fairgrounds? What have I observed that would help me? Where's a place I would seek cover? Where's a store I would duck in, an alleyway, a street I would duck onto to get out of the way of the situation? You know, obviously from a psychological standpoint, when we're confronted by something so frightening, we're in that, you know, fight or flight mode, we're not going to be making very good decisions. We're not going to be in a state of mind to be picking out those safe routes of escape. So as we train in all sorts of environments, whether it's an office or a school or people in the community, to look at any sort of risk of violence, whether it's the shooter or the driver of a hostile vehicle, I think what we do best in training is shifting some, I wouldn't say responsibility, but some of it, at least the strategy to our population that says you're not powerless. Now, very interesting, psychologically, we always use this expression that action binds anxiety, that when you give people clear instructions about what to do, it actually helps them be less fearful. And I think if we're just telling them, hey, be aware of this new risk, there's this, you know, push and this propaganda in the terrorist channels right now for these kind of attacks at mass gatherings, it does make them more aware, but it's a very frightening message. I think we need to balance that in our discussion and our training with what to do. And that's that discussion of situational awareness of both the risks and resources. What am I looking for? And when I see those things, what do I do for, you know, safety and survival? But also going in, how do I start assessing any situation at a higher level of vigilance, as I said, for risks and resources? What are the things that may hurt me? What are the things that may help me in any kind of violent event, and in this discussion, in the instance of a vehicular attack.
Great. You raised some good points there, Steve. Just for our listeners out there, we have a number of resource sheets available on our website that you can definitely check out and download after this podcast. Moving on, over time, what do you think the true impact of events like this are on not just society, but more so individuals directly affected by these types of terrorist attacks?
Well, those are kind of two different questions. I mean, if we think of terrorists or terrorism at the strategic level again, its goal is to create the maximum degree of psychological, social, and economic disruption. If we then come back to something like the vehicular attack, it actually does that well from the terrorist standpoint. So if the question is, you know, what's the kind of impact on our community or society of this form of terrorism, of the use of vehicles as a terrorist weapon, it's actually really interesting and kind of insidious because it starts to erode community cohesion. I mean, think about where some of these attacks have happened. If we look at the attack at Bastille Day in France, in Nice, it's their Independence Day. It was a day of national pride. It's a huge gathering. And what that says then to a community, whether it's in Nice or it's Patriots Day with the bombing at the Boston Marathon, these were otherwise very positive, patriotic events, events that fostered a sense of community closeness. And not only is this sort of attack intended to hurt victims, hurt individuals, it actually kind of tears at our societal fabric. It says to folks, you need to be concerned about going to a large public gathering because these big gatherings are targets. So at a societal level, it could actually have kind of a chilling effect. And as I said, that plays well into the overarching strategy of the terrorist. Obviously, at the individual level, for a family who has had an individual member of their group hurt or killed in an attack, the traumatic stress, the grief, the bereavement, all of those very personal, powerful, psychological, sometimes cultural and even existential and religious impacts are tremendous. They're life-changing, they're catastrophic, and very often are going to alter the whole trajectory of that individual or that family's life. So terrorism really operates at both those levels, right? I mean, it operates at that collective level of affecting the community and the society, and sure, it operates at that individual level of the people who were the direct victims. So both of these are happening simultaneously.
Great, Steve. That's a lot of great information. What can you tell us about the tactical aspects of how the public can survive or defend against these types of attacks?
I think at a tactical level, we need to be giving instructions to people on how to survive or defend against these attacks. So you may have seen in the article, one of the things they says is, as you go into an environment, say you go into a parade, to think for yourself, for your family, where would we stand that's going to be a safer place? Knowing that a vehicular attack is a possibility, maybe a very slim possibility, are there safer places to stand? Standing at street corners are better than standing in the middle of the block because it means that we have side streets that we duck in. When a vehicle builds up speed for an attack, it doesn't turn. The driver wants to continue momentum in a straight line. If I've identified there's a store open, there's an alleyway, there's a place for me to duck in, have I tried to scout out where there's barriers, security barriers or bollards, or where there's positions of safety for cover and concealment, myself and my family would be that much more safer. So people show up with a parade, and what do? We look for the best place to stand for the view. We know in vehicular attacks, most people who are hurt or killed are people along the curb line. So although that's a great place for convenience and for fun, it actually is not a particularly safe place to stand. So how do I continue to go to a parade? I continue to go to a big public event, but maybe with a different level of awareness of the risk, but also a different level of awareness of what I can do for myself and my family. So we can educate the public and educate others about the strategy of terrorism and the strategy of using vehicular assault as a weapon of terrorism. But I don't think that that helps people much. I think that somewhat is useful, but it still leaves you feeling very vulnerable. You're saying, wow, even the authorities are saying this is a real risk. What can I do? Because I still like to go to the parade. I still want to be there with myself and my family. How do we do that smartly and how do we do that safely? I think is a discussion that individuals and communities benefit from.
Thanks, Steve. I just have one final question for you today. Is there a certain strategy you feel that the Homeland Security enterprise should respond to with regards to this evolving threat?
Well, just I think that as we see terrorism evolve, and it always does, it can seem a bit to be like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, the terrorist introduces a new threat. Whether it's a CBRN or a chemical, biological, or radiological sort of threat, or it's more conventional violence such as bombing, shooting, or kidnapping, we, in response, as law enforcement and security, as intelligence communities, we react and we get good at detecting that, perhaps, and responding to that. And just as we do, it seems that the terrorists kind of invent a new method, and they're always keeping us on our toes. In some ways, as I said, that can be unnerving for all of us. But as I said earlier, some of the strategies and the techniques, some of the approaches that we've taught people and we continue to teach people about other forms of mass violence, such as I said, an active shooter event, they actually apply to all forms of mass violence. So we're actually better equipped and probably better positioned to deal with new threats, something that seems relatively new, like vehicular threats. We're probably better positioned to deal with them than we think sometimes. Honestly, if we stop going to parades, going to the fair, going to the farmer's market because we're afraid to be out in these big public spaces, obviously that's when the terrorist wins. So understanding kind of the nature of terrorism in general, understanding how something that seems new like the vehicular attack plays into that, but also being aware that we have good defenses, both as our systems, but individuals and communities knowing what to do to respond to all kinds of mass violence, we're actually in a much, much better position to continue to be ourselves, to live without fear and to do the things that are important to our individuals, as our families and our communities.
Definitely some valuable information there. Again, Steve is the Director of Training at the Disaster and Terrorism Branch for New Jersey's Division of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And thank you, Steve, for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Jerry.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.